So we now turn our Bibles to Genesis chapter 42. A brief synopsis of the story up to this point. Jacob had 12 sons by four different wives. The wife who he loved dearly, Rachel, bore him two sons. Because of his love for Rachel, they became his favorite sons. And they were two of his youngest sons, Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Jacob were not too honorable. Joseph was. But there developed a friction between the boys because of the dishonor of the older sons and the honor of Joseph. They were treacherous. They were cruel. Joseph was more compassionate. They were jealous of Joseph, of his father's obvious favoritism. Joseph had a couple of dreams, made them really angry. He dreamed that he and his brothers were out in the field binding their sheaves of barley, and his brothers' sheaves all bowed down to his. Really upset them to think that they would bow down to Joseph. Then later he dreamed that the sun, moon, and stars bowed down to him. His father sent Joseph out into the area of Dothan, where his brothers were keeping the flocks, to find out how they were doing. And when they saw Joseph coming, they said, "Here comes that dreamer. Let's kill him and we'll see what happens to his dreams then." The oldest brother, Reuben, said, "No, let's not kill him. We don't want to get our hands bloody. Let's throw him in the pit and let him starve to death." And so as Joseph came up, they threw him into the pit. And he begged for mercy, asked him to bring him out and all, but they just had no heart towards him whatsoever. And then when they saw a caravan heading towards Egypt, Judah suggested that maybe they should sell him as a slave. That way they haven't killed him and they've gotten rid of him. And so they stopped the caravan and they sold their brother Joseph for 20 pieces of silver, who was taken then by these traders down to Egypt, where he then was auctioned and bought by a man whose name was Potiphar, who was the captain of the guard for the Pharaoh. Joseph, while in Egypt, was a diligent, faithful servant in the house of Potiphar. Potiphar was blessed because of Joseph's diligence, but his wife cast lustful eyes upon him and sought to seduce him. When Joseph refused to be seduced, one day she grabbed him by the coat, tried to disrobe him and force him into bed. And he fled from the house, leaving the coat in her hand. And she, being scorned, began to cry rape and reported to the servants and then later to her husband that Joseph had attempted to rape her. As a result, Joseph was thrown in jail. He was 17 years old at the time that his brothers sold him as a slave into Egypt. Just how long he was a servant in Potiphar's house, we don't know, presumably 10 years. While he was in prison, he was a model prisoner. Soon they made him sort of the head over the prison, and he had charge of all of the other prisoners. During that time, the butler and the baker were cast into prison because they had come into disfavor with the Pharaoh. That is the Pharaoh's butler and baker, and they both of them had dreams which Joseph interpreted, in which the butler was to be restored to his position, the baker was to be hung. The dreams came to pass. Joseph said, when you come into the Pharaoh, don't forget me. Tell him about me. But he forgot Joseph, and Joseph remained for another 2 years there in the prison. Until the Pharaoh had a dream. And he called his wise men and his magicians in to interpret the dream for him, to tell him what it meant. And they were unable to do so, and then suddenly the RNA began to buzz in the brain of this butler, and he said, oh, king, I've done a horrible thing. There is a man of the Hebrews, he's in prison, and he is able to interpret dreams. The baker and I both had dreams, and he interpreted them, and it came to pass, as he said, he could interpret your dream for you. And so they ordered Joseph to be brought quickly, and he shaved and came in before the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh said, I understand that you can interpret dreams. And Joseph said, not really, I can't, but God is able to give to the Pharaoh a answer of peace. What is your dream? And the Pharaoh told Joseph the dream of the 7 cows being eaten up by 7 skinny cows. And Joseph said, God has told you that there will be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine, which will be so great that the lean years will eat up the fat. Appoint a wise man over the kingdom during the good years. Gather 20% of the crops, put them into storehouses, so that when the lean years come, you'll be able to distribute to the people and you'll be saved. The Pharaoh said, I cannot find a wiser man in all of the kingdom than you, because only you were able to tell me what the dream meant. And so he took his signet ring and gave it to Joseph and said, you're in charge. Only I am above you in the land. And he ordered that when Joseph went out in the chariot, that the people would go in front of him crying out, bow down! And they would bow down to Joseph as he rode the chariots through the streets. And during the 7 years of plenty, he gathered into storehouses until they lost count of the abundance of grain that was gathered in the 7 good years. But then began the lean years. And so we come to chapter 42. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob, the father of Joseph, Jacob said to his sons, why do you look at one another? Now, they were probably looking at each other in sort of a, what are we going to do kind of a thing. You know, how are we going to survive? Why are you looking at one another? I hear there's grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die. Now, Jacob was an extremely wealthy man. He had the money to buy the grain, but if there's no grain to be bought, your money doesn't do you any good. But there is grain in Egypt. I hear there is. Go on down and buy it. So Joseph's 10 brothers, the 11th Benjamin, stayed home with his father. He was Joseph's youngest brother, and at this time, Joseph was 37 years old. He was 17 when he was sold by his brothers. He had been in Egypt now for 20 years. He was probably 37, 38 years old. It could be that it was a while into the famine before they had to come down. His brother Benjamin would now be 23 years old. The last time Joseph saw him, he was just a little kid, about 3. He hadn't seen his little brother Benjamin for a long time. He was the only full brother to Joseph. But because Joseph was thought to be dead, Jacob sort of protected him, and he took the place of Joseph in the heart of his father. So the 10 brothers came down to Egypt to buy grain, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity should befall him. And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. People were journeying from all over down to Egypt to buy grain because word was out that there's plenty of grain in Egypt. So they came with these other people who were journeying to Egypt to purchase grain. Now Joseph was the governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all of the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. And I can imagine at that point, Joseph remembered the dream. In fact, in verse 9, it tells us that he did. Saw his brothers bowing down. And that dream where he had gathered together his sheaf, interestingly enough, the grain. And his brothers' sheaves all bowed down to his. And as they are bowing down and their heads are on the ground and all, and he's standing there, I imagine that that dream flashed back in his mind. Now, inasmuch as he was only 17 when they left, he was about 38 now, they didn't recognize him. Of course, he was dressed as an Egyptian, and he spoke to them through an interpreter. He would not speak in the Hebrew language to them, but used an interpreter to speak to them. So Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Joseph recognized his brothers, they didn't recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them, and he said to them, "You're spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. You've been sent by a government because they've heard that we've got plenty of grain and you're going to bring down your armies and invade us and try to take away the grain. You're spies." And they said, "No, my Lord. Your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are honest men." Now, I don't know that I would agree with that, but in reality, what they are asserting is, "We're telling you the truth. We're not spies. We're telling you the truth. We're really brothers. That's the truth. We're telling you the truth." They're honest in this. They weren't honest in other things. When they sold Joseph, they took his coat, highly recognizable by his dad. They killed a little goat, put the blood on the coat, tore it up, and took it to the dad and said, "You recognize this coat?" And he said, "Yes, that's the coat of Joseph. Surely he has been torn by wild beasts." And they allowed their dad to grieve and believe that lie. Dishonest. But in this they are telling the truth. "We're honest men. We are your servants. We're not spies." And he said, "Ah, don't give me that. You've come down to see the nakedness of the land." And they said, "No, we are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." They didn't really know what had happened to Joseph. Having lost track, the one isn't around anymore. He's no longer there. But we are 12 brothers. And Joseph said to them, "It's just like I said. You guys are spies. And in this manner you're going to be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. So one of you go on home and bring your brother, and you will be kept in prison that your words may be tested to see whether there's any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, you are spies. You'll be executed." So he put them all together in the prison for 3 days. Now, I think that probably there is a bit of revenge that Joseph is taking in this whole scene. there are those commentators who do ascribe to Joseph higher motives than that. They say that Joseph believed in the promises of God that through this family, the nation should be developed from which the Messiah would come. That Jacob had shared with his sons these truths of God, and that Joseph believed it. And he really was seeking to prove his brothers and to find out if indeed any changes had taken place in the 20 years that he had been gone from them. Perhaps. But I think that Joseph's enjoying this whole thing to an extent. He had spent 3 years in that prison in Egypt because of what they had done to him. He had spent several years in servitude to Potiphar. The last 7 years have been good, and the two children that he had during the 7 good years, he named the first one Forgetting, because God has caused me to forget all of the toil and the grief that I had. But he is giving them really a bad time. So for 3 days, and they don't know that it's only 3 days, they sit there in jail. They don't know that it's Joseph. They don't know that he's just giving them a bad time. Far as they know, that's the rest of their life. They're in the slammer. They're in Egypt, man. What are they going to do, you know? So on the third day, Joseph said, "Now I want you to do this and live. I won't kill you right now. For I fear God." Now that should have given them a little bit of insight. Here's an Egyptian, as far as they are concerned, who were very polytheistic. And yet he is declaring to them, "I fear God." If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in the prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, and so shall your words be verified, and you shall not die. And so they did so. And then they said one to another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." Guilt is a hard thing to get rid of. Our brain is a marvelous computer, and it has tremendous capacities of storage. That little RNA can store up so much information. And all it needs is the right stimulus to pop that information back into the screen. Have you ever seen someone and you thought, "I know them. Where do I know them from? What is their name? I know them." And you try so hard to remember and you can't. And then maybe you're driving down the street. Flash. Their name? "Oh, sure, you know, that's John. Wow, yeah." And all of the information that you have in your storage bank up there gets flashed on the screen, and you remember. It's stored there. The brain has that tremendous capacity. Well, what is also stored there is every sin you've ever committed. And all you need is the right stimulus to pop it in. It's interesting how that many times events of our lives are stored with maybe a song. So that you hear a certain song on the radio and it'll cause the processes to go to work and certain experiences. That old black magic. No, that's for us over 45. One summer, I spent several weeks up at Matilaha. And the jukebox, that song was popular that summer. And every time I hear that song, I flash back on Matilaha and that summer that I spent up there and the great time and all that we had. It's just associated with that memory. And that's the only stimulus I need to remember that summer at Matilaha. Another summer at Bass Lake was related to the song, the Beer Barrel Polka. And it'll trigger a flood of memories. Now, they are in distress. Their lives, as far as they know, are on the line. This guy is treating them rough. He's really putting them through the paces. They've just spent 3 days in jail, and one of their brothers is going to be bound and kept in jail, and he thinks they're spies, and man, he's mean, he's tough, and they said, "We're guilty." We saw the anguish of his soul, and we didn't do anything. We didn't listen to his pleas. We're getting what's coming to us. And they realized that though they had tried to get rid of the sense of guilt for what they did to their younger brother, still it is coming back and haunting them. Guilt is so hard to get rid of. You may think that you have repressed it. You may think that, you know, you've gotten that out of your mind and now you're free. But given the right set of circumstances and that haunting guilt is still there and rises as a specter. But it's so important to get rid of guilt. From a psychological standpoint, guilt creates the subconscious desire for punishment, which is manifested in self-injury accidents or in neurotic behavior patterns. Guilt can drive you crazy. It can make a nut out of you. It can make you do nutty things. And that is why when you go to a psychologist after you're doing all these weird, quirky things, the first thing he seeks to do is find out what you feel guilty about. Gives you a battery of tests. Finds out what you're doing that makes you feel so guilty because you have a subconscious desire to punish yourself and thus you've started the neurotic behavioral pattern. You're doing all these weird things to bring upon yourself the disapproval from your peers, the rebuke, the punishment. Because subconsciously, I desire to be punished because I know I did wrong. From a spiritual sense, guilt will destroy you. The wages of sin is death. The soul that sinneth shall surely die. And guilt, unconfessed sin, can bring you into an alienated relationship with God, where you no longer hear the voice of God, you no longer see the glory of God, you no longer feel the presence of God. You're spiritually dead. And as the psalmist said in Psalm 32, when I sought to hide my sin, there was a constant roaring inside of me, such a turmoil. Your hand was heavy upon me. And there was no moisture within. I became as dry and parched as the drought of summer. Oh, how sin, how that guilt can just shrivel you up inside spiritually. You've got to get rid of it. These guys had carried it for 20 years. For 20 years they had hid their secret. And now, faced with real problems, it's still there. We're guilty. Of what? 20 years ago. Wait a minute. 20 years. But it hangs on until it is removed. And the only thing I know that can effectively remove guilt is the blood of Jesus Christ. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. For the blood of Jesus Christ, God's Son, cleanses a man from all sin. It'll do for you what no psychologist can do. It'll wash the slate clean. You've got to get it washed. Otherwise, psychologically, it'll make you a neurotic, and spiritually, it will destroy you. Reuben, the oldest brother, answered them saying, "Didn't I speak to you? Didn't I tell you don't sin against the boy? You wouldn't listen." "All right, now look what you've done. Therefore, his blood is now required of us. Told you guys to let him alone. Wouldn't listen to me, would you? Now look what you brought on us." Reuben, he's trying to exonerate himself. And indeed, if you go back in the story, it was Reuben who talked them out of killing him and to throw him in the pit. And Reuben had intended to come back and get him out of the pit and send him home. So in essence, Reuben is innocent in this and was going to help Joseph. And had went away when the brother sold him. When he came back and Joseph was gone, he was extremely perturbed. So Reuben is indeed innocent in this, and he is reminding them now of how he warned them, and now look what you've done to us. But they did not know that Joseph could understand all that they were saying. For he spoke to them through an interpreter. And it was really too much for him. He turned himself away from them and he began to weep. Then he turned back to them again and he talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. Had them bind Simeon up before their eyes. They're still acting tough and gruff. And, you know, carry him off to prison. I suspect that Simeon was the ringleader in selling Joseph and in killing Joseph. He was probably the guy. See, Reuben was the oldest brother. He was seeking to protect Joseph. Simeon was the next oldest, and I believe that he was the inspirer of the conspiracy against Joseph. Judah was trying to protect Joseph too. He's the one that suggested, "Let's not kill him or let him die here. Let's sell him, that his blood won't be on our hands." But I think that Simeon was the one behind the whole thing. And so Joseph is going to get Simeon now. "Bind him up. Take him off to jail. You guys get your grain and get out of here." So Joseph gave the command to fill their sacks with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them. So they loaded their donkeys with grain and departed. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey some feed when they had made camp, he saw his money. And there it was in the mouth of his sack. And so he said to his brothers, "My money's been restored. It's there in my sack." And their hearts failed them. And they were afraid, saying to one another, What is this that God is doing to us? Oh, man, you know. Guy's going to think that we ripped him off, stole the grain. How are we ever going to go back and face that guy? Then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and they told him all that happened to them, saying, "The man who is the Lord of the land spoke roughly to us, and he took us for spies of the country." But we told him that we were telling him the truth. We were honest men. We weren't spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father in this day in the land of Canaan. But then this man, the Lord of the country, said to us, "By this I will know that you are telling the truth. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for your famine and for your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me. So shall I know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you may trade in the land." So, when you come back again, bring your youngest brother. Prove that you're telling the truth. And if not, then don't expect to see my face. Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly, each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. Oh, man, what's happening to us? And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me of my children." Joseph is no more. Now, it would seem that Jacob is sort of suspicioning these fellows. He is accusing them of bereaving him of his children. So it could be that somehow Jacob came to suspect them in regards to Joseph. "You've bereaved me of my children, for Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more, locked up in jail in Egypt. And you want to take Benjamin away. All these things are against me." As far as he could see, yes. And we so often with Jacob, with our limited vision, with our inability of seeing past today, we look at the circumstances of our life and we say, "Everything is going against me." Peter said one of our problems is that we only see that which is near, the nearsightedness of the believer. My inability to peer into tomorrow, into next week and next month, and looking at my situation today, looking at the difficulties that I'm facing, I'm often prone to cry out with Jacob, "Everything is going against me." That's only because I don't know the full plan of God. Jacob didn't know the full plan of God. Jacob didn't realize that this rough lord in Egypt was none other than Joseph, the son whom he loved. He didn't realize that before long he was going to be embracing Joseph, weeping together with him for joy. He didn't know the wonderful things that God had in store for him in the whole renewing of the family ties. And being able to see only up to this point, he cried, "All things are against me." Not so. And in your own life, when you're prone to cry out, "All things are against me," that's not so. All things are working together for good to those who love God and are the called according to His purpose. Wait for the next chapter. And you'll see the plan of God unfold. You'll see the completion of God's plan. And you'll see that it is far different than what you think it to be at this point. And so it is my faith and trust in God that sees me through those dark hours when I think from the circumstances that everything is going against me. It is my faith in God's promise and faith in the Word of God that sustains me, that keeps me going. And I know that when I turn the corner, things are going to be different. Because God is working out His plan in my life. And God said, I'm thinking of you constantly. David said, if I should number the thoughts of God concerning me, they are more than the sands of the sea. The next time you get discouraged, go down to the beach. Sit in the sand. Just take it up and let it trickle through your hands. Throw it in the air. Try and count the grains as they come down. Look along the beach and try to guess how many grains of sand are on that beach. And if I should number God's thoughts towards me, they are more than the sands of the sea. God's thinking about you constantly. And then God said, I know my thoughts concerning you. They are good, not evil. God isn't thinking, well, now how can I really teach him a lesson that he'll never forget? And what kind of miserable thing can we put him through now, you know? No, no, no. God is thinking of how to bless you and how to show his love. How can I demonstrate to them that I really care, that I am in control, that I love them? And God's thoughts to you are good, not evil. Oh, how glorious. To be a child of God. To be under the Father's care and concern. He thinks about me constantly. And I think of how when my little grandson came home from Sunday school and said to his dad, Dad, is it true that God's watching me? Chuck said, why would you ask me that, William? Oh, I said, my Sunday school teacher said God was watching me, and I just wanted to know if that was true. Chuck said, why did your Sunday school teacher tell you that God was watching you, William? William said, I was being naughty. But he said, I want to know, Dad, is that true? Does God really watch me? Chuck, being a wise father, said, yes, William, it is true. God is watching you because He loves you so much He can't take His eyes off of you. God's thinking about you. Because He loves you so much He can't get you out of His thoughts. You ever been so in love that you just can't get the person out of your mind? Thinking about them constantly, that's the way God is with you. He's just gone bananas over you. He just can't get you out of His mind. Thinks of you constantly. Oh, how glorious it is to be loved of God. All things are against me. No, no, no. You don't know all things. You only know part of the things. And you're making judgment from incomplete knowledge. You don't know the whole truth. Wait until you get all the facts. And you'll see it's quite different than what you suspect. When all the facts are in, if you do too much complaining now, you're going to have to come back and apologize to God. How many times I've apologized to God? Because there were those places where it looked real tough and I thought all things were against me and I told Him so. And then when He finished the picture, oh, how wrong I was. God was working the whole while. His plan of love in my life. So Reuben spoke to his father saying, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. And put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you. Talking about Benjamin. If I don't bring him back safely, then kill my two sons. Oh, Reuben, you know, you're still unstable. You're making wild. You know, what good would it do to kill two of your grandsons? I mean, you know. It's just sort of a wild kind of a thing. You just say something because you know, and that's Reuben, unstable as water. Now, interestingly enough, you see, 20 years has gone by, remember. And so in those 20 years, we don't know much of what was happening to Joseph's brothers. We know quite a bit about what happened to Joseph. We were following him. But meanwhile, back home, all we know is that one story of Judah and Tamar in the 30th chapter. But we really don't know much of what was going on back home. But what we do find out is that the other sons got married. They had children and they had families and all, which was only natural at this point. Reuben at least had two sons. And he promises them as a surety for Benjamin. But Jacob said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he's left alone. And if any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave." No way, he's not going, forget it. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "You better go back and buy us a little food." But Judah spoke to him, saying, "That man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You'll not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you don't send him, forget it. We're not going down. For the man said to us, you're not going to see my face unless your brother's... You don't understand, Dad, what's going on down there. That guy is mean. Guy's tough. And we're not going to go down. We just won't go unless Benjamin goes with us. That's all there is to it." And Israel said, "Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether or not you still had another brother? Why would you tell him that kind of stuff? What's the matter with you?" And they said, "But the man asked us pointedly about it. He asked us about our family, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' And we told him according to these words. How could we possibly have known that he would have said, 'Bring your brother down'? I mean, don't give us a bad time. How would we know he's going to say that?" Then Judah said to Israel, his father, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones." So Judah here indicates that they also had children, all of our little ones. Now, you know, let me have him then, let's go, so we're not going to die of starvation here. "And I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. I'll take the personal responsibility for him. Hold me personally responsible. For if we had not lingered so long, by now we could have already gone back and gone down there and we would have been back already with the grain. Now come on, we got to get going. Let's not stall around any further. Give him to me, I'll be the surety for him. We've waited too long already. We're getting hungry. We've run out of food." So their father Israel said to them, "If it must be so, then do this." Oh, Jacob. Still conniving. Still using that scheming process. "If it's got to be, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man. A little balm and a little honey, spices, myrrh, pistachio nuts and some almonds." Now these are things that were not found in Egypt to any extent, and these were the things that those traders were carrying, interestingly enough, when they were heading to Egypt and the brothers sold Joseph. They were carrying balms and spices and all down to Egypt to trade, because those were the commodities that they didn't have in Egypt. I imagine that, again, the O-R-N-A, you know, carry balm and spices and, Joseph. "And take double money in your hand, Take back the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks, for perhaps it was an oversight. And take your brother also and arise and go back to the man, and may God Almighty, El Shaddai, give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. And if I am bereaved, I am bereaved. Jacob was brought to the point of that full commitment. Okay, go. And if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. I mean, I'm facing, you know, the ultimate worst thing that could happen. You remember Esther made somewhat a similar statement when her cousin Mordecai was insisting that she go into Ahasuerus the king and plead for the people. She said, I can't go in unless he bids me. If I just intrude in there, unless he raises the golden scepter, the guards will take my head off. That's the rule. And he said, now look, don't think that if this decree is carried out that you're going to escape being in the palace there. And if you fail, God will save His people. And how do you know that God hasn't brought you to the kingdom for just this purpose? And so she said, okay, I'll go in, pray for me fast. And if I perish, I perish. I'll do it. I'll step out. Take the consequences. If I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. I just have to commit it into the hands of God. I can't do anything about it. It's out of my control. Just that commitment where you just rest in the providential care of God. So the men took that present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand, and they arose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with him, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my home. Slaughter an animal and prepare a feast, for these men are going to dine with me at noon. Then the man did as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. Now when the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's, that is his brothers, when they brought them into Joseph's house, they really thought, uh-oh, we've had it now. He's going to get us because of the money that was in our sacks. It's just the whole plot. I can see it now unraveling. He's taking us into his house and then he's going to really nail us because the money was there in our sacks. So he's just looking for an excuse to fall on us and to kill us, you know. Make us slaves. Take our donkeys. Man, we've had it. So when they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house, and he said, oh, sir, we came down the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came to our camp that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money full weight, and so we have brought it back in our hand. And we brought other money in our hands to buy some more food. We don't know who put the money in our sacks. But the steward said, peace be with you. Don't be afraid. Your God and the God of your father must have given you the treasure in your sacks because I had your money. And then he brought Simeon out to them. So the man brought the men into Joseph's house and he gave them water. He washed their feet. He fed their donkeys. And then he made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, and they heard that they were going to eat bread there. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house, and they bowed down before him to the earth. Then he asked them about their well-being. And he said, is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive? And they answered, your servant, our father, is in good health. He's still alive. And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted his eyes and he saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. And he said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Now, he wasn't old enough really to be, Joseph wasn't old enough to be his father, but yet he was the younger brother of Joseph, a full brother. 23 years old. Joseph hadn't seen him since he was, probably 24 at this time. Joseph hadn't seen him since he was 3 years old. "That's my brother, my full brother. God be gracious to you, my son." Now, his heart yearned for his brother. He wanted so bad to go over and just hug him, kiss him. His heart yearned. So Joseph made haste, looked for a place to cry. And so he went into his chamber and he wept there. Overcome with emotion. But then he washed his face. He still had to carry out his little plan here. And he restrained himself and he said, "Serve the bread." So they set him in a place by himself and them by themselves. And the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews. That's an abomination to the Egyptians. So there were three tables. Joseph had his own table. The other Egyptian guests had a table for themselves, and then his brothers all had their table. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another. When Joseph set them at the table, he set them according to their age around the table. And they looked at each other and thought, "What's going on here?" 11 brothers. Do you know what the chances are of setting 11 according to age around the table? 39,941,000. He had about one chance in 40 million to set them in the order according to age. And it freaked him out. As they realized, they thought, wow, you know. And they evidently at this point figured that, you know, this guy had some divining knowledge. In fact, Joseph led them to believe that he had the capacity of divination. As we get into the next chapter, we'll find it quite fascinating as the plot thickens. And Joseph, first of all, passes off the fact, "Don't you know that a fellow in my position is able to divine?" You know, and they no doubt believed it because of the order around the table and the fact that he was able to set them according to age around the table. Then he took servings to them from before him. But Benjamin's serving was 5 times as much as any of theirs. And so they drank and were merry with him. Now, It could be that Joseph was looking to see if the same kind of jealousy and bitterness that they had towards him was also manifested towards Benjamin. This could have been sort of a test to see if they were still the old guys that they used to be, bitterly jealous of the younger brother, who was obviously favored by the father. He wanted to see if that was still there or was that gone. The purposes of God cannot be fulfilled through them as a nation if there's still a semblance of that old bitterness and jealousy. But obviously it wasn't there. They all just had a good time, feasted together, and had a good time. Now, chapter 44 and 45, you're going to love them. As you get into the story, as the plot thickens, and then as the whole thing comes together, you're going to just really love your reading for next week. Don't forget, in the fellowship hall, There are those who are gathering for prayer. And if you desire special prayer, you have a personal need, you'd like to just share with someone and have them pray for you, we encourage you to go over to the fellowship hall and be ministered to. And now may the Lord bless you, keep His hand upon your life, give you a beautiful week as you walk in fellowship with a God who is madly in love with you. So much so that He can't take His eyes off of you because He loves you so much.